So we're thinking about David and Goliath this morning. And as I said, when I first knew the story, there were little details about it I was always very quick on, like how many stones did David use? Did you pick that bit up? One. Yeah, he picked up five, but he only used one. I was always good at that kind of detail in Sunday school. But I haven't got a clue really what the story was about, but I knew it was in the Bible and I knew it had to be important. So let's talk about three things this morning. One of them is image. Okay, one of them is image. One of them is conviction. And the last one is weapons. Let's talk first of all about image. Can we take the first slide, please? How big was Goliath? Can you remember? Well, that's interesting, you see, because if you read the books about this, it says that either he was 6'9" or he was 9'9". And the reason there's a disagreement is because when we got the Bible, we didn't just get it like you get it now, you know. So when they wrote the Bible, they didn't suddenly produce that. There were lots and lots of different books. It's made up of 66 books and lots of different manuscripts. And you see that manuscript at the bottom there. That's the oldest Bible manuscript that we have. It's very, very old. It's between 2,000 and 2,500 years old. It's not an original. It's a copy of an original, but that's the oldest one that we've got. And when they wrote the Old Testament, they put together various texts. So there were, they had the Dead Sea Scrolls that we found actually just about 100 years ago, less than 100 years ago. They had one called the Septuagint, another one that they could use for information was Josephus. And then there's the famous one that people who go to college study, which was the Masoretic text, which is quite a young text, actually, not an old text. Now, in the Masoretic text, it says he was 9'9", but in all the other places, it says he was 6'9". So he's either 6.5 cubits, a cubit's 1.5 feet, or he was 4.5 cubits. So there's a bit of scholarship behind that. You can't be absolutely sure how tall he was. I've never met anybody who was 9'9" tall. The tallest man in recorded history was 8'9½, Robert Watlow, or I can't remember his name now, and he got too big, really, for his body. And in the end, he struggled to get around because he was so huge. But if you're talking 6'9", then we've got some comparisons. So who's that on the left there looking at Goldberg? Anybody know? Goldberg on the left, the right is known as the Undertaker. He is 6'7½". But for those of us who are a bit older and remember professional wrestling, who is that? Giant Haystacks. He was actually 6'9½". It could well be that that's the size that Goliath was. Whether he was 6'9" or 9'9", I wouldn't fancy going into a ring with either of them, really. Far too big for me. So he was a big fella. And people take notice of size. You know, we have sayings like, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. But actually, when you see somebody who's big and muscly, you tend to kind of walk past, don't you, and not say too much. But then the narrator kind of rubs it in. Not only is he that tall, he then describes the weapons he had. He had a helmet. He had a coat of chainmail to protect his chest. He was wearing greaves. Greaves is a name for shin guards that that you wear. And then it says that he had a spear, the tip of which weighed 20 pounds. That's 3 kilograms. No, not three. Yeah, it is 3 kilograms, isn't it? Is it more than that? Terribly funny. It's 8 kilograms, is it? Yeah, okay. So heavy, you know, he's carrying all that stuff around with him and pretty fearsome. Next, it describes his rant. He had a big voice. Now, some people are good with words, aren't they? They're quite scary and they're quite loud. I'm sure EYLA boys will know that from bitter experience. And here was a man who was very confident and very self-assured. Send out your champion. And I'll tell you what, we'll have a fight. Let's save ourselves the bother of a battle between two armies. Just send out your champion. We'll have a fight. And if he beats me, we'll serve you. But if I beat him and kill him, then you will serve us. It's amazing, this kind of image that the narrator builds up for you. Here is a giant, and for 40 days he comes out in the morning and the evening with the same taunt and says, come on, send me your champion and I will deal with him. And everybody is totally intimidated by him. Now, as a society, we are obsessed with what's on the outside. We see the outside naturally, don't we? And we become very obsessed. Can we take the next slide? So cosmetic surgery is a major industry now. Do you know how many people in America in 2010, I haven't got recent statistics, but in 2010, how many people in America had a nose job? 250,000 people went and had nose jobs. That was the second most popular surgery. I won't tell you what the most popular one actually was. Okay, and blokes become very obsessed with how they look. Now, here's something that you could do. Let's take the next slide. So, here's what somebody managed to do in the space of 3 months. That's how he started out. After 1 month, he was like that. After nearly 2 months, that. And after almost 3 months, that. It's pretty impressive, isn't it? I might give that a go. So, we have become particularly obsessed with that. And yet, why are we so obsessed with what we look like, the outside? Why? Because sometimes the inside doesn't kind of follow suit. When Israel picked their first king, they had Saul, and Saul was head and shoulders above everybody else. He was impressive to look at, but actually he was a lousy king. He disappointed. By that time, you would have thought Israel had kind of understood that actually God doesn't look on the outside, he looks on the inside. When David was chosen to be the king, he was the youngest of 8 boys. And Samuel came to the family and went through all the other 7 and thought, one of these must be it. And none of them were. And he said, is that all the sons you've got, to Jesse? And Jesse said, well, I've got one more, but he's only a teenager, you know, it can't be him. And in comes David, and Samuel sees a quality inside David that belies his stature, and David will become Israel's greatest king. So think about image this week. Think about how much our society shapes what you think about yourself, how much the outside seems to matter. Because when you come to church, God says the exact opposite. What really matters is what's on the inside. That's the bit that he's interested in developing. Okay, so let's leave that picture now and come back. The second thing I want to talk to you about is conviction. Okay, we talk a lot about confidence these days, and certainly Goliath had confidence because he had every good reason to have it. And we talk a lot about being confident in your own abilities. You can do anything if you put your mind to it or if others invest in you. Now, one of your boys, or maybe more than one of your boys, goes to Eton. He's about to go to Eton. Now, how much research have you done? Okay, how many prime ministers have we had in England altogether? Okay, I don't expect you to know that because I didn't know it. 54. How many of them went to Eton College? Out of 54 prime ministers, 19 of them trained at Eton. It might be the 20th, who knows. But actually, that's quite interesting. And we used to have a guy in this church, Al Pearson, who went to Oxford University. And he said, it's interesting how they set the whole thing up, because they had a debating society and they constructed the entire room like the House of Commons. And you went along to this debating society, and the idea was that you got used to the way it worked, because the people who were schooling you in Eton and also in Oxford wanted to get you into those positions of power in the future. Now, there's a kind of positivity thing about that, and there's obviously some truth in it. But that's not what this story is about. This story is about conviction rather than confidence. It's about passionate faith, not youthful nerve. And David stands up and sees these cowering Israelite soldiers. And he says to them, who is this Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And this isn't just good talk by David. David actually believes it. David is convinced that God is great in a way that Saul and his army are not convinced. Now, apparently, it may interest you to know, there are 2.2 billion Christians in the world. Total population of the world is somewhere between 7 and 8 billion. Over a quarter of them, apparently, are Christians. But here's the question. How many of those really believe in their God? How many of them have really absorbed the values that Jesus taught? Because here you've got this story of Saul and his army, and they are apparently followers of the Almighty God who can conquer any enemy. And the minute this tall man stands up and says, come on then, come and get me, they all cower. So do they believe or don't they believe? And then along comes this young lad who stands up and says, they've got a nerve coming out and saying that and challenging the armies of the living God. Here is the one person, and he's not even in the army yet, who is actually somebody who really believes in the God that he says he believes in. We have a word which is nominalism. Nominalism is where you say you're a Christian, but you're a Christian in name only. You don't really believe any of it at all, but you kind of go along to church and all that stuff. But really, you absorb all your ideas and all your values from somewhere else and not from the Bible. It's funny, actually, because I always reflect on this church building. When you come into this church building, you will see three doors. There are two central doors and there are two green doors either side. Now, this church was built in 1882. And back in 1882, you would, if you went back to society in those days, you would find that for girls between the age of 15 and 25, a third of all girls were servants. And that was a difficult job to do. You had to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning. You went, lived in the premises of somebody quite rich. You got up at 7 in the morning and you were probably working flat out until 10 o'clock at night. If somebody wanted a bath, they didn't have taps and running water and a boiler or anything like that. You had to boil the water, pour it into buckets, carry it upstairs, pour it into the bath, walk down again, boil some more water until you kind of got the bath full. And then when the bath was finished, they didn't have pipes to drain it all away. You had to empty it out by hand and carry it all downstairs again. You had to polish their shoes. You had to make their meals. You get very little pay at all. That was the kind of society that we were in the 1800s, a very unfair, unequal society. The prospects for a young woman and a young man who was in service were very, very difficult. And guess what? When we built this church, we built it because we bought in to that kind of society. So below this floor, there were a load of pews and all the well-to-do people sat down there. But all the servants who had to leave the service early to go and prepare the lunch for the rich people, they came in the two side doors and they walked up the stairs and they sat around here. And there were some chairs up there as well. Two people separated, the rich people downstairs and the poor people upstairs. And I say to you, what is that about? Christian architecture, when you want to embrace the values of Jesus, actually what you're embracing is the values of 19th century Victorian society. How sad is that? That's what I mean by nominal. Christian in name only, but not really absorbing the true values. We're not actually in the business of building self-confidence, not that it's a bad thing. We're in the business in the church of building conviction. And at the end of this, we're going to sing that song, How Great Is Our God. Well, how great is he? How great is he in your life? How much of a part does he really play in the person that you are becoming? And David is prepared to put his money where his mouth is. Let no one lose heart on account of this Philistine, he says to Saul. Your servant will go and fight him. They're the kind of people that we need, people of conviction, people who really do absorb what the Bible is all about and put it into practice. That's the kind of thing that I hope will be built into your lives. And here's the third thing, weapons. Saul tries immediately, that David says he's going to go and fight. Saul immediately tries to accommodate David to the conventions of war by giving him his armor, which is too big. David's not as tall as Saul. And all that kind of hefty stuff of this chain mail that you've got to stick around your chest and shin guards and all the rest of it. In the end, as you laughed as it was read, he couldn't even move. You know, how am I going to kill this bloke if I can't even walk with all this stuff on? And so in the end, he takes different armor, takes different weapons. He goes down to the stream, he picks five smooth pebbles. He uses what he's used to using. And it wasn't that he was a marksman with a sling. People say, oh, he must have been really, really good with a sling. It wasn't particularly that he was a marksman, kind of Robin Hood with a sling. God it was who gave him the accuracy that day. But I want you to get that thought, that here is David using different weapons to everyone else. And when David stood before the giant, he said this, "You come to me carrying a sword and spear and javelin as your weapons, but I come to you in the name of the living God. The battle is his, and he will give you into my hands." They're good words, aren't they? You don't change the world by using the world's weapons. Albert Einstein once said, "You cannot solve problems with the same consciousness that created them." You can't resolve violence with more violence. It just creates bitterness and resentment, and it's an endless cycle. You have to bring something new to the table, something transformative. And Jesus took all that to a whole new level, perhaps to a level that even David himself wouldn't have understood. He called his followers to fight evil with God, good, not evil with evil. And here are five stones that Jesus might have chosen, if you like. If you'd like to have a look at the next slide. Virtues like humility, gentleness, kindness, transparency, and goodness. They're all laid out in Matthew chapter 5 and Galatians chapter 5 as well. That act of kindness, it doesn't amount to much in our eyes. When we talk about leadership and stuff like that, we don't often think of that. But there's something. I was talking yesterday to one of the parents about Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn was invited by Ed Balls to go and see a performance that his daughter had organised. And he was an hour late because he had another meeting beforehand. But he got in there for the final hour. And then afterwards, he lingered and just chatted to the children for a full hour. He must be one of the most busy people in the country. And yet he found the time just to chat to the children. There's something about that kind of gentleness, that wholeness, that kind of kindness that is different and challenges the way that the world is. Jesus said to his disciples, "I send you out as sheep among wolves." What chance have sheep got among wolves? But nonetheless, the church has survived and Jesus' name has survived through the centuries. It sounds like madness, doesn't it? But that's the cause that I want to live for, and I hope it's the cause that you want to live for. Image, conviction, weapons. And finally, this story. Some of you have heard me tell you this before. A Baptist minister of a former generation, a man called Frank Cook, said that he used to do a thing in church on a Sunday evening where before the sermon, sort of midway through the service, the church secretary would come up. They had a little box at the back of the church and people would put their difficult questions in the box. And she would get the questions out and she would come up, and halfway through the evening service, she would start to ask him the question. He didn't get any sight of these questions at all. And she would ask the questions and he'd give his answers as best he could. Final question one Sunday. Mr. Cook, if you were to discover that having been a minister all your life and having been a Christian for most of your life, if you were to discover that actually there's nothing there, that when you die, there's nothing, would you feel that you've wasted your time? And Frank Cook said, he edged it a little bit to begin with, and he said, if there's nothing, then I wouldn't have that level of consciousness to even ask the question. She said, come on, come on, you know what the question is asking. And he said, no, I wouldn't regret it. He said, because when I look at Jesus, I see everything that I would like to be and everything that I would like my children to be. So take that away with you and take away the story of David and Goliath. Take away that idea of what's important in your life. What is the outside image that you want to project, or is it the inside image that matters more? Take away what are your convictions that you're going to carry through life, and what are the weapons, what are the ways that you're going to show those convictions? May this story actually make a difference to the way all of us live. Amen.